Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking to Fraser Cameron. He's presently on the faculty at the University of Southampton in England, very close to the Isle of Wight, where my parents were. And his initial training was a systems design engineer, whatever that means. But he's applying systems design to biomedical aspects of science. Fraser, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you.
How on earth did you become a systems design engineer, and why?
Well, I mean, engineering was somewhat obvious. I mean, I took apart all of my toys when I was growing up and put them back together again. And by and large, when I see any mechanism, I try and figure out, you know, how it works and why is it designed that way. Yeah, it was a somewhat obvious thing. I liked, you know, the idea of building bridges, the idea of solving mechanical problems.
Did your parents sort of buy into this and enjoy playing with you? And
I mean, to some extent. I mean, they certainly allowed me to get a computer, which then had, you know, Quick Basic on it. And so, you know, I'd code up some stuff in that and, you know, learn how everything worked.
All right.
And, of course, they humored me when I asked how things worked. And they explained it to me. And, you know, so that went from anything mechanical, because my father was relatively adept at that, to macroeconomics. So how does, you know, GDP interact with interest rates and, you know, all sorts of thoroughly esoteric stuff.
Have you used that particular aspect to make yourself a lot of money?
No. I mean, unfortunately, the market ought to be a random walk. So only if I think I know more than the people on Wall Street can you really use that. So, and no, I don't.
Okay, so you moved to biology instead.
Yeah, rather circuitously. So, I mean, in a roundabout fashion. So I got my master's and my PhD in aeronautics and astronautics, so rocket science, which, of course, doesn't really have anything to do with biology when you think about it. So, I mean, when I tell people that I now do biomedical stuff, they always ask, do you work with astronauts? And no, of course I don't. But it turns out that the mathematics for an autopilot in an airplane can be applied to a whole bunch of things. I mean, be it cruise control in a car, be it regulating the fuel air ratio mixture in an engine, or as it turns out, trying to regulate the glucose level in people with type 1 diabetes.
So they've all got a basic common set of algorithms that you can work with and sort of try to perfect.
So fundamentally, you're dealing with an input signal that you're trying to get to a certain value. So you have a glucose level that you'd prefer to have kind of between 70 and 180 milligrams per deciliter. And you have something that affects it. So in this case, we're talking about insulin pumps. So that can inject insulin, which tells the body to store energy, aka glucose, and it effectively drops the glucose level, which can allow you to bring it down into your target range.
So it's a reiteration process that you can monitor, pump, cease, and carry back on.
So you get a signal of the glucose over time, and you've got the question of what insulin do you want to give or what insulin do you want to withhold.
Does it apply this sort of concept to any disease and drug delivery? Because I never understood quite how people decide what amount of drugs to take and how often to take them if you're not monitoring regularly.
The problem gets – there's simple versions of the problem and there's kind of more complex versions of the problem. Where I tend to get involved is when you've got a periodic measurement of your signal of interest, so in this case glucose, and you can change, say, the insulin on – a pretty frequent time frame. So type 2 diabetes is actually a really good comparator here. So in type 2 diabetes, the control problem is actually a lot simpler. And as a result, it doesn't really require somebody with a PhD to do research on it. What you do there is you give one shot a day of a certain amount, and then you free up the pancreas to deal with giving insulin for everything else. As opposed to type 1, where you have to actually think about meals and you want to think about giving kind of 6 or 7 shots per day.
Type 1, type 2 diabetes, what's the big distinction?
So they used to be called youth onset and adult onset. So type 1 was youth onset and type 2 was adult onset. Another way of kind of dividing it up is in type 1, you lose the ability to produce insulin completely. So without insulin, your body doesn't store energy, and so your glucose levels go way up, your muscles don't get energy, badness happens. For type 2, you become insulin resistant, and the risk factors for that are age and genetics, inactivity, and obesity. So it tends to happen, not surprisingly, when you're older. But it's just insulin resistance. Your body can still produce insulin, but not enough. So it's kind of a slow degradation and not necessarily a complete loss of ability to produce insulin. So you just need to kind of help the body out. In type 1, the body loses its ability to cope entirely. And so you need to provide insulin from the outside. You need to provide exogenous insulin.
Are both 1 and 2 genetically related in any way?
Yes. So again, the risk factors for type 2 are genetics.
Yes. The
risk factors for type 1 is definitely genetics. As to whether or not they're linked, I don't think so.
This is a particular target that you're working on now, diabetes, and that's a big problem in the southwest of the United States.
Yep. Type 1 diabetes is, I think, roughly 5 to 10% of the total diabetes population.
So tell us then, I mean, apart from you're trying to design then feedback mechanisms so that when the insulin level gets to a certain threshold, in comes the pump. I mean, that's the bottom line.
So that when the glucose level gets too high, we administer more insulin. Yep.
All right. So what other diseases have you got on the horizon that you think, once you've sort of successfully cracked this particular issue, assuming that it will be cracked?
I mean, there's inevitably a fair bit of work in cracking this.
Okay. Tell me, what are the problems?
For roughly the last kind of 15 to 20 years, engineers have been saying, we'll have a solution for it in 5 years. We're now getting to outpatient trials. So there is clear, obvious signs of progress. So, I mean, there's hope. There's hope for sure. So the problems are basically that we can't recreate something that is as good as a pancreas. I mean, the pancreas has direct access to the bloodstream. That makes life really nice. So we're giving insulin from outside of the body. And when we do that, we inject it roughly 5 millimeters under the skin. So, I mean, minimally invasive, you're not going to have any infection problems from that. But that insulin reaches about peak action in 45 to 60 minutes and then lasts for about kind of 3 to 4 hours. By comparison, the pancreas gets to inject insulin directly into the bloodstream. It's done acting in 15 minutes. So the insulin that we are injecting acts far slower than the insulin the pancreas injects. Now, that wouldn't actually be a problem if the disturbances to the glucose level were really, really slow. But it turns out when you drink a Coke, it's going to be in your bloodstream in probably a half hour to 45 minutes completely. So if you want to try and blunt the effect of that Coke with insulin, you really want to get as much insulin delivered immediately as you can. You don't want to have to wait for that half hour and 45 minutes before you finish giving insulin. So you want to try and anticipate some of the effect of meals. Which, of course, leads to all sorts of interesting conundrums, like what happens if you anticipate something that doesn't happen?
Right. I mean, I was thinking nobody is making cola that's also got insulin added to it. I mean, it's as stupid as it sounds, or as clever as it sounds.
It's an interesting idea.
Right.
And if the body wasn't so darned good at digesting, it'd work wonders.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the body's really darn good at breaking stuff down in your stomach. So if you were to put insulin through the stomach, it would just get digested into its constituent amino acids, and now it's
lickety
not going to do
anything. Time. So there is no oral insulin available.
Careful. So you were suggesting that you would be drinking it would go into the stomach. There is inhaled insulin, more like an asthma inhaler, not through the nose, through the mouth. And in fact, that's a little bit of an interesting story that I unfortunately can't quite tell you, but there's some questions as to what happened to the inhaled insulin, because it was indeed, I believe, a little bit faster than the regular insulin that we give, than the liquid that we inject, I guess. That exists, and there are on the horizon a number of ways of trying to get faster insulin. Basically, ways of improving insulin so that I'm out of a job, or at least a research project, which would be wonderful.
I should know, but I don't know. I don't know the structural formula of insulin. But do people play with modified insulins? I mean, you think of the drug industry, and you've got drug X. And then along someone can say, well, if you put a methyl group here, it might get off patent, and it might make it work better. Do people play around with modified insulins?
I have to assume they do. The parts that I'm familiar with is, so when insulin is injected, it's a big bundle of insulin molecules,
right,
that then dissociate into, you know, individual insulin molecules and osmose into your bloodstream and then act. So they've been looking at ways of trying to get it to dissociate faster, trying to get it to go from a big clump into individual molecules faster. So that's one of the methods. And there's actually a couple of interesting ways that they've been looking at doing that. The first is that you can try and inject it instead of 5 millimeters under the skin into the fat layer. You can try and inject it a little bit more shallowly, a little bit shallower, into the area of the skin that actually has a whole bunch of blood vessels. In other words, you get more interface with the blood. It's going to dissociate faster. It's going to get into the bloodstream faster. It's going to act faster. And it turns out that's roughly 20% faster.
Okay.
So they have some trials for that. There's a bit of an impediment in there insofar as if you come up with an insulin that's faster, or if you come up with a way of speeding it up, then to get it approved, it's an entirely new drug. You can't say, this is like insulin. You have to get it reapproved.
And the principle there is because it's so rapidly going into the blood system, it makes it different acting?
I think it's because it acts differently. For whatever reason, the FDA treats it separately.
Would that be the same in Europe? You're living in England now. How do they handle it over there?
I need to be a little bit careful here. So there's definitely different approaches that different regulatory agencies take. Yeah, there's different incentives for the different regulatory agencies. When you think about the FDA, they get penalized for the things they approve that do harm. They don't so much get supported for the things that they approve that benefit. That's just assumed. It's their job. We take it for granted. So one of the things that was at issue early on in this process was that there were a number of trials that occurred in 2007 or so. And they were deemed not significant risk by the university review boards that were in charge of all of this. And then somebody talked to the FDA and they looked at their list of questions. And their list of questions included, does this involve a drug that can do harm if you get rid of all the mitigations? And of course it does. Insulin is a drug that has significant action. If you take too much of it, you die.
How and what happens when you have too much insulin?
So
is there such a disease where some people produce too much?
I have heard of people saying that when they eat, they produce a little bit too much insulin and then they go low afterwards. I don't think there's a disease that has it, or at least not one that's particularly common. So at some point, somebody talked to the FDA and they asked that question. And then all of a sudden, it was a major level of concern and there was a whole bunch of additional regulatory burden. And some groups decided to simply do a lot of studies elsewhere.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. We're talking to Dr. Fraser Cameron, currently at Southampton University in the south coast of England. And we're talking about delivery systems for drugs because he was a systems design engineer. And yep. He's using his knowledge to try and have controlled delivery. In this case, we were talking about insulin for people with diabetes. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neeson. A few years ago, we learned cigarettes create not just first and secondhand smoke, but third-hand smoke. This is a family of toxic chemicals left by a cigarette long after it's been snuffed out.
Now we have more reasons to avoid it. Research shows chemicals from third-hand smoke, or THS, bind to our DNA, causing damage and mutations that could lead to cancer over time.
Cigarette smoke has over 4,000 pollutants, and they linger on carpets, furnitures, walls, even the dust in the air. As some THS pollutants accumulate over time, they become even more toxic. They also transform into new compounds when mixed with indoor pollutants like ozone and nitrous oxide to form carcinogens.
Among these is NNA, which is similar to a known potent carcinogen called NNK. In the new study, NNA bound to human DNA. Cells exposed to these carcinogens increase DNA damage within 24 hours and can cause uncontrolled cell growth, leading to cancer.
We take in these compounds when we breathe or touch items in areas exposed to third-hand smoke. But kids ingest these compounds when they put a toy in their mouth, crawl on the floor, or bury their face in a parent who smokes and has it in their hair and clothes. It's even worse for babies with developing lungs.
Depending upon the type of compound, they can last for hours, weeks, or even longer. When smokers quit, they need to take great measures to clean their home. Carpets should be changed, the walls painted, or even replaced. But the benefits are enormous.
44 million American adults smoke. It kills more people than HIV, illegal drugs, alcohol, car crashes, and firearms combined. Now, there's one more reason to quit.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Dr. Fraser Cameron from the University of Southampton in England, and we're talking about drugs, drug delivery. In particular, we've been focusing on diabetes. And just before the break, we got into the sort of conversation about regulatory agencies. And you made a very good point that I'd never sort of actually heard before, and that is the FDA in the United States gets punished if it makes bad mistakes.
Yeah.
When it does something right, we assume that's what you're supposed to be doing.
Yep.
There must be other regulatory concepts in different parts of the world that then don't concentrate on the negatives but just reward you for the positives and make it less cautious?
Yes. So, for instance, the CE mark in Europe, you have to prove that your device won't directly cause harm. And that's about it. Indirectly, well, it could cause harm, but they're not going to deal with that. Alternately, you can get some regulatory agencies that say, oh, this could be a nice source of funding. This could bring in money, research dollars. And so they might advance it. There's a number of lobbying agencies. So, for instance, the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation that obviously has a really large vested interest in getting these devices made and researched. And not surprisingly, they also have a huge vested interest in keeping their kids safe. And so, I mean, they tried to apply about as much pressure as they could to get the FDA to act faster, to get them to recognize that realistically, somebody with type 1 diabetes is probably safer in a trial than not in a trial. Because when you think about it, if you're in a trial in a clinic setting, first off, you're already in the hospital. Second off, you're being monitored by a nurse roughly every half hour and or a physician. I mean, if something was to go wrong, they'd fix it quick.
So I mean, that's interesting. So the people in these studies are not just living a normal life and coming in once or twice a day or a week, but they're actually in a hospital environment because their need is that critical?
So initially, they're in a hospital environment.
All right.
But we should back up a little bit. So type 1 diabetes imposes a burden of glucose regulation on the person. And if you avoid that burden, then you get health consequences. Anything from kind of lethargy and eventually seizures and sluggishness and whatever. So on the low end, effectively, you're shutting down your brain. You're depriving your brain of energy. On the high end, you get a whole bunch of chronic issues that affect and degrade pretty much every system in the body. But if you are good at managing your blood glucose levels, there's no other effects. I mean, you can live a normal life, full lifespan, all the rest of that. So it just imposes a burden. And it's a burden that's constant. You 5 or 6 times a day, spread out nicely throughout the day. So you can live a normal life if you pay attention to it. So they do indeed live a normal life. They go out, they ride horses, they do everything. But for the initial clinical trials, when you're dealing with devices and algorithms that you haven't really tested before, it makes a lot of sense to have a whole bunch of mitigations in place.
And so have a controlled environment effectively.
Yes. And for that matter, you're making sure they're not out running a marathon. So exercise uses energy. So not surprisingly, it drops the glucose level.
All right.
And one of the conundrums that's going to occur here is what happens when somebody with type 1 diabetes is wearing a controller and they do something that the controller realistically can't deal with? Because, I mean, if you burn all of the energy that you have in the glucose in your body, well, the controller can't create that energy. All it can do is tell your body to stop storing it. But if there isn't any left, there's not any left. So, I mean, there's inevitably going to be situations where the patients can get themselves in a situation where the controller isn't powerful enough to deal with it.
You were talking about the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation.
Yeah.
And you were pointing out that there's a mixed sort of emphasis there. They want to get new products, new ideas out to the patients, but they also have to be very, very careful about not going too fast, pushing too much.
Well, I mean, they've actually been a major funder of this research. They're trying their darndest to get algorithms out there and to get several of them out there. They want devices to be competing in terms of price because, of course, they don't want to have to pay too much for all of this. But they do recognize that by and large in these trials, the patients are safer than they are outside of it. But they also need to be, and for that matter, the researchers need to be very careful that whatever gets to market is indeed really safe, because we don't want to be in a situation where there is actually a device out there that causes harm that then leads to an FDA investigation that then leads to stymieing of approvals for not only that device but a whole bunch of devices in the future.
You keep mentioning device, and I'm trying to picture what this device is. Is this some implant that you have with a dosage of insulin that reads the glucose levels constantly and releases as needed?
There's a bunch of ways that this can work. What I think is going to be the first one. So they have continuous glucose monitors, and those are effectively a little device that sits on your skin, taped down, and it puts a tiny little electrode 5 millimeters down. There are also insulin pumps that, again, sit on the skin and put a tiny little catheter 5 millimeters into your skin. The connection between them currently is the patient. What I'm seeking to do is to replace that with some algorithm, some procedure for deciding what insulin to give. And that's just software. That's just code. Or alternately, it's just a chip. So if you're, say, Medtronic, you have combined insulin pumps and CGMs, and you have a little device that sits on your belt, and that can have the algorithm embedded into it. So ideally what we're looking at is one device that's taped to your skin. That would be the most user-friendly version of it.
Going back to a question right at the beginning, there are conditions where this type of delivery and monitoring is already out there as a gizmo?
And actually this is fairly recent. The Medtronic 530G, I think. Or alternately the Medtronic VO. So this is another indicator of the FDA. So a number of years ago, it was approved in Europe.
For what, though?
My apologies. This is the Medtronic device. They have a continuous glucose monitor and an insulin pump. And they have a really, really simple rule that just makes tons of sense. If the glucose level goes below a set threshold, then it suspends the insulin pump for either 2 hours or until the user responds, which means that if you're going low in the middle of the night, and because you're low, your brain is a little bit starved of energy, you're lethargic, you're really good at sleeping through alarms, then this will simply suspend your insulin pump for 2 hours, which, generally speaking, causes your glucose levels to go back up into the not dangerous range, and then you'll probably actually hear your morning alarm. So it's a really sensible idea. Got approved roughly 2 to 3 years ago in Europe and maybe kind of a year ago in the U.S.,
In Europe, when they approve, is this part of the European Union, or does each medical
I believe
issue
it's
in
the
country?
European Union.
All right.
The CE mark is certainly across Europe.
So they've got one agency, rather like we do here. What about Canada? You come from Canada. Is Canada sort of independent in this, or do they take a lead from the FDA?
They're definitely independent.
Good.
In fact, we're collaborating with the University of Western Ontario, and they submit separate regulatory submissions, I guess.
So, but, I mean there is a Canadian equivalent to the FDA.
Yes, and it requires fundamentally the same information.
Right. I mean, and do you know of any particular areas where they really diverge in their attitudes or their conclusions?
No, I'm not familiar with any areas where they do. I mean, the only area that I really have knowledge, they've been in sync.
Let's assume that, you know, within the 5 years that you said at the beginning of your talk that engineers are going to say we've whipped this problem. You've still got a long career ahead. You're a young man.
Yeah.
What are you going to do when the problem is solved?
So first off,
because you've got to get tenure somewhere.
Oh, yes. Inevitably. So first off, within 5 years, we might have the standard problem solved. There are inevitably a whole host of situations that make this more complicated. I mean, think about pregnancy. You now have not only one glucose system, you've got two of them. And of course, you've got it in a situation where you care about safety even more. Alternately, think about sickness. So there's a whole bunch of other hormones that are going around because your body's busy fighting off stuff. And that creates a whole bunch of uncertainty as to how well insulin is going to work. And of course, you're already sick, so you care about safety. And there's There's going to be a whole bunch of wrinkles.
Okay, I got it.
This.
So the point is that you're looking at the healthy diabetic at the moment because
yes.
that's the one you can go after.
Then
you start
simplest.
To look
yes.
at people who have got diabetes yeah. plus other conditions.
Yeah. Hit the biggest nail first.
All right. So, I mean, you're still going to be looking at diabetes and insulin.
For a while. But, yes. of course, I mean, as a professor, I'm going to want to be in a whole bunch of different research areas. And I certainly want to be doing the biomedical side of things. So one possible option is if there's some sort of feedback in chemotherapy where you're trying to maintain the health of a whole bunch, basically the rest of the body, and you're just trying to destroy the cancer cells, there might be a point at which you can get some periodic measurements that tell you when, say, the cancer cells are becoming resistant to this particular agent, in which case that's a point at which you might want to switch. Or you might want to be regulating the dosage of it to try and trade off lack of harm versus killing the cancer cells.
In the end, it's all coming down to gizmos, devices, doing all of the work for us. And I see Google just released information about its three little completely automated motor cars that don't need people in them to get yep. anywhere. But on the other hand, if you're in it, it will take you where you want to go.
Yeah.
This is the future for mankind, doing very little, it seems. Thinking.
Well, yep. I mean, fundamentally, we need to have some people that embed the intelligence in all of these devices. And I mean, don't get me wrong. The Google driverless car is – it's ridiculously cool. And it has the capacity to
– It's even got smiley face on the front.
I didn't see that picture. But and it has the potential to vastly increase safety. The part that I think that is really nice about embedding control algorithms in and automation is that these devices pay attention all the time, whereas we don't. I mean – somebody with type 1 diabetes would really like to be able to ignore the fact that they have it.
But do you ever wonder what the future of Homo sapiens is?
Oh.
I mean, you know, less and less to do. I'm a chemist. More and more the synthetic chemistry is taken over by instruments and not people. Driving is going to become a rare pleasure, if it's a pleasure
yep.
at all. Where are we going as a species?
More leisure.
Yeah, but to do what? Because then you'll have a little damn machine that'll hit the golf ball for you. I mean, if you're a golfer like I am, or skiing, you just sort of put your little thing on the Google hat, and it'll take you where it's safe to go.
But why would you want to? You just take off the hat and enjoy it that way. Alternately, you play chess against your grandson instead
because you stand a chance of winning, at least I would. Computers are very difficult. But there is an issue here. More and more leisure. You know, life isn't just for leisure.
Life isn't just for leisure. But what it's going to do is transition us into the brain ideas, making it more important for us to figure out how to think and to figure out how to embed the intelligence in the devices. Because fundamentally, we are going to be the ones that are able to think and look at it from a large picture.
But the problem is we're also the people that define what we call intelligence. And that has a whole rat's bag of curious ideas out there.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Science Studio. Our guest today was Fraser Cameron, currently at the University of Southampton in England. So we hope you enjoyed the program. Fraser, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And thank you, Norma Martinez, for putting the program together as usual. And thank the listeners out there, as usual, for listening. Bye-bye.
Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Dynamica Expo takes place November 14th and 15th this year in El Paso Civic Center. The expo will inspire and propel medical innovation among the region's researchers and entrepreneurs. Early registration ends today. Register at dynamicaexpo.org. Thank you to Sierra Providence Health Network, title sponsor of Dynamica.